You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On her nightly show, Emmy Award-winning MSNBC host Rachel Maddow tackles a range of topics with her trademark wit, an approach she's also brought to her new book called Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, about why we are, as she puts it, a country weirdly at peace with perpetual war. Rachel Maddow was on our show this past March, and listeners told us they really enjoyed our conversation, so we thought we would re-air it this holiday week. I began the interview by asking her, is your title Drift meant to imply that American national security and military policies are totally rudderless?
I am trying to imply two things. One is that we have become, as the subtitle implies, unmoored, a little disconnected from the constitutional inheritance that was supposed to link what we did with our military to the democratic impulses of the country. But the other idea with Drift is that this is not a conspiracy. There is nobody, I don't think there is anybody out there who sought to change the connection between our democracy and our military for some nefarious purpose to undermine the country. I don't think that the military is trying to take over and act autonomously.
But we're kind of drifting into
this. We have drifted into this without foresight.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter who's in the White House, it seems.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that presidential decisions matter. And when you're talking about any decision involving the largest organization on earth, which is the U.S. military, a small, seemingly small decision can have very wide impact. But I have not seen presidents of either party interested in divesting themselves of the, I think, extra constitutional powers that they've inherited from their predecessors.
We're well into a decade of wars, some declared, some undeclared. We're in Afghanistan, Iran, Libya. We might add Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and there are others. Do you think Americans have accepted as this situation is almost normal?
No. I think it has been normalized, but I think we are upset by it. I think that there is discomfort that's non-ideological, that's even affects people who don't much care about politics. I feel like, and I personally felt, the reason that I wanted to write the book, unsettled and uncomfortable with the fact that these wars were happening so separate from civilian life, that it didn't feel like the military, it didn't feel like the country was at war. It felt like the country had sent the military to war and we weren't supposed to trouble ourselves much about it. I think that's a foreign concept to Americans.
But partly because we don't have a draft anymore.
In part,
it almost feels like the military, we have a professional army.
I think, yes, but I don't think bringing back the draft would be a magic wand. I think it's interesting. You hear a lot of sort of pining for the draft among people who are uncomfortable with the distance that we're talking about here. But I don't think it would fix it.
And so much of what we're seeing today is done by new technologies like the drones. Do you think that also keeps us a little distant from it?
Again, like the draft, I think it I think it factors into it, but I don't think that it is a qualitative difference from previous forms of warfare. I mean, even before guns, if you go back as far as the catapult, we've always been able to project force away from the person exerting it. And so that's all, we've always been somewhat insulated from the harm that we cause. Now,
the most popular movie in America right now involves a girl who uses bows and arrows.
Yeah. And you know, part of the way that we think about the risks of war is whether or not, as an aggressor, we are also vulnerable. And maybe that is changed by drone warfare. But that's always been, I think it's a quantitative difference, not a qualitative difference.
So why do you think the recent end of the war in Iraq was met with such little fanfare? Is it because the White House was afraid that it makes it vulnerable to attacks from conservatives of both parties?
I don't think the White House could have made a decision that made us feel differently about how to mark the end of the war that could have made us feel differently about it. I am very interested in the question of whether or not New York City ought to hold a traditional New York City style ticker tape parade to mark the end of the war. The Pentagon has expressed that they don't want that to happen, even though they're happy for other cities to do it. But I think the fact that we didn't feel it as a nation, it didn't feel like a momentous change, that there was a sort of collective shrug, oh, was that still going on, is a symptom of what this book is about, which is that war has become more invisible and more frictionless for civilians.
And you write early in it, our national security policy isn't much related to its stated justifications anymore.
That's what happens when debate doesn't matter. Debate gets sloppy. When Congress
Have we had enough debates this year?
Well, I don't know that the Republican presidential debates are the model for rigorous back and forth, but You know, you look, one of the things I write about at length in the book is the debate before Gulf War I. And say what you want about the whether or not Gulf War I was a good war or well decided or well ended. If you look back at that debate, Congress was debating that war as if lives depended on it, because lives did depend on it. And the debate was a good debate. And it was not ad hominem. It was not questioning one another's patriotism. It was a solid, rigorous debate that Congress took very seriously and the country paid attention to. And that's because Congress knew it counted.
So that all changed after 9/11. Is that why the debate sounded quite different before we invaded Iraq?
I think we have incrementally changed over time so that the debate has become something that we think that we're doing for show. We don't think it's actually determinative of whether we go. We think that presidents decide whether we go alone.
Well, is this simply the fault of Congress? What about the media?
I think that the media, you know, I think back to how the the lead up to the second Gulf War could have been different. And had the media seen its role as facilitating a rigorous and important and determinative debate, we would have been in a very different position. But there's other things that should have been different, too. We should have been paying for it. We shouldn't have been giving ourselves a second round of tax cuts right before we invaded Iraq, having given ourselves one just before 9/11.
But we're seeing some similar rhetoric right now in regard to Iran, aren't we?
We're seeing a cavalier enthusiasm about the prospect of war with Iran voiced by people who will never do the fighting themselves. And I find it very upsetting.
Also people who, in most cases, would not want to see taxes raised
to pay
well.
For it. Well, yeah, there's the, there is this, the way that that Iran gets talked about, I think the sort of flavor of the cavalier way in which it gets talked about is that it wouldn't have any cost for the United States, that invading Iran would just be a matter of toughness, not a matter of sacrifice.
Well, Israel would be going to war with Iran, and we would be backing it up, is the way it's argued. But also, yeah. Aren't we waging, at least allegedly, a covert war against Iran's nuclear program, the whole Stuxnet thing?
Well, the arsenal of things that we are using around the world against Iran and its nuclear program, against terrorism in places like Somalia and Yemen and other places undisclosed, against not only al-Qaeda-linked terrorism suspects, but also even people support the Pakistani Taliban in Pakistan. All of these tactics are very, very are occluded from our view. We are not allowed to know. And in part, that is operational secrecy has always been a national security concern. But I think that presidents, and even with the consent of Congress, have gravitated toward more secret forms of warfare so as to evade accountability, public accountability and scrutiny for what we're doing.
My guest is Rachel Maddow. Her book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, is published by Crown. You write, by 9/11, the war-making authority in the United States had become, for all intents and purposes, uncontested and unilateral, one man's decision to make. How did we get to that point?
You know, it's I think that we made decisions over a period of about 30 or 40 years. No single one of those decisions brought us to that point, but they accumulated. And so when we decided that when we wanted to deploy people, that we would bolster the ranks of the deployed with people who worked not for the U.S. military but for private contractors, so that we never felt the full brunt of how large the deployments had to be. We never felt the full blunt of the casualties. I think that helped. When Congress decided, after having sort of gotten up on its hind legs after Vietnam and insisted on their constitutional prerogative, that Congress got to decide whether or not we waged war. When Gerald Ford, frankly, wanted to go back into Vietnam and the Congress stopped him and they used even the threat of appropriations to stop him on that. Congress, I think, eventually decided that while that might have worked then, they were not interested in taking that much heat and that much accountability moving forward.
But didn't the process begin to some degree when President Johnson kind of ramped us up into the Vietnam War?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And this actually goes to the point that you made earlier about the draft, too. It's fascinating to look back at LBJ's reasoning about how to wage this war in Vietnam, which he was not an enthusiast for. Obviously, he had campaigned saying, we don't want to send American boys around the world, you know, thousands of miles away to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves. He did not want that war. And when he became convinced that it was necessary, he decided that what he wanted to do was wage the war without selling it. And he did not want to make a fuss. And so not making a fuss for him meant using the draft. It meant not calling up the Guard and Reserves. That would get too much attention. He thought the draft would be a way to keep it quiet.
In fact, George A. Carver, who worked for LBJ, later said that the president, quote, tried to fight a war in Vietnam without acknowledging he was fighting a war.
Yeah. He did not want to defend the full scale of what he was doing.
Are we doing something similar in some cases, like our participation in the war against Libya, Gaddafi, where we were kind of there and denying we were there at the same time?
Well, I don't know that we ever... I don't think I saw it as denying that we were there. I mean, one thing that is, I think...
Well, downplaying.
Downplaying. But I think also the president genuinely made a decision in the case of Libya that the United States would not be in the lead of that military operation, that it would be a multilateral thing, that we would not be there without the interest of other Arab and Muslim-dominated countries.
And he was criticized for that.
He was absolutely criticized for that. There was certainly a sector on the right that wanted a much louder, much more aggressive stance. I think that the country mostly didn't go along with that criticism of him. But presidents matter. Presidential decisions matter. But the thing that I don't think you can expect any president to do is give up presidential power. It's like an aged rubber band. It keeps stretching and it never goes back.
And that's why Congress really didn't play any role in the decision to go to send planes over Libya.
There was a gesture at the War Powers Act, but that was it.
You say that it was Ronald Reagan who changed the way Americans think about the military. In what way?
Well, I think that Ronald Reagan had an understanding that he earned firsthand, especially in his first primary campaign for president, which he lost, that sort of stirring American both fear about our national security threats, but also stirring American pride in our military was a winning issue for him. And I don't fault him certainly for the pride part of that. I think I do fault him for the fear-mongering part of that. I mean, for him to have made the case when he was running against Gerald Ford that the Panama Canal was essentially going to be the end of American sovereignty was, I think, it's worth laughing at that. It's worth making fun of Ronald Reagan for that. But he knew that it worked. And so he used that throughout his presidency to accomplish all sorts of goals.
But you said a little earlier that once the door is open, and we saw that also with Iran-Contra and some other things, once the door is open, each president will not try to close that door. They will, because the door is open, they automatically will try to go through it themselves.
Well, one thing that, yeah, in Iran-Contra, I think there was one of those inflection points, one of those things that happened that changed us forever. In Iran-Contra, Reagan obviously made a decision to overtly go around a declarative statement by Congress that he could not do something he wanted to do, and decided to do it secretly and illegally. And it was an outrageous action, an outrageously illegal action by the Reagan administration. But more importantly, I mean, honestly, I wish that was more a part of Reagan's legacy. But more importantly, for the purposes of how we got to where we are now as a country, in trying to get Reagan off the hook, for that, his administration developed a defense for what Reagan did that was a radical and, frankly, ridiculous concept of presidential power, that presidents could do anything they want as long as it related to national security. And that is the part that we never gave up.
And someone like Dick Cheney really pushed that hard. He was actually that thinking was formed by his response to Iran.
This is why I'm desperate to interview Dick Cheney, because not because of his post 9/11 action so much, but because
or his recent operation.
Or his recent operation, you got to wish him the best. But the actions that he took as a Wyoming congressman, as a backbench Wyoming congressman, when the country and the entire Congress is absolutely horrified by what Ronald Reagan has done in this illegal thing that he did on Iran-Contra, and not only wrong in the letter of the law, wrong in the spirit of the law, and doing arms deals with Iran and the whole rest of it, Dick Cheney writes a minority report in Congress and says, actually, I think that Reagan was totally within his rights to do what he did. And who cares when you're a backbench Wyoming dissenting congressman? But when you end up then becoming defense secretary and then vice president, and in fact, the most powerful vice president of the modern era, that crazy minority opinion, I think it's a crazy opinion, becomes determinative for the whole nation.
My guest is Rachel Maddow. Her book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Rachel Maddow. When she isn't conducting her show on MSNBC, she has been writing a book. This is a book that's been in the works for a long time, hasn't it? It's got to be something that has to be seen as nonpartisan, because you've written it through both Democrats and Republicans in the White House.
I essentially got this book contract as an infant. It's been a long time. I have had this idea bugging me for a long time, and I don't enjoy writing, and writing takes me a really long time, so I never was totally confident this book was going to come into the world, but now that it's here, it is in fact what I meant to say, so I'm glad I did it.
Robert Gates, whose name is the title of Chapter 16 in the Iran-Contra Independent Council Report, went on to be named Secretary of Defense by both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Has the increased militarization of the United States been a bipartisan project?
I think that it has. This is not something on which there is a partisan divide. I don't even think there's much of a liberal and conservative divide on this, both in terms of the impulse to fix it, the sense that there's something wrong, and also the way that we got to this problem. One of the things that I write about was in the Balkans under the Clinton administration. There had been sort of a pilot project on whether or not basic military logistics could be outsourced to private companies. And in the reinventing government phase of the Clinton-Gore administration, they were very, very enthusiastic about turning military functions over to private contractors, but not just to save money and have the potatoes peeled theoretically more efficiently. But also, the Clinton administration was very happy to use private contractors to get around political constraints that would have prevented them from training some of the armed combatants in the Balkan conflict.
Do you think the American public has been adequately informed about these things? Many people seem shocked when they learned that Hosni Mubarak was using tear gas canisters stamped made in the United States against protesters, despite the fact that Egypt has been one of the largest recipients of our military aid.
Yeah, taking Congress out of the decision tree as much as they have been, and also outsourcing what used to be under military lines of authority to private contractors. In both of those cases, the effect is to insulate not just the process, not just the debate, but the outcomes, what it is we are actually doing, what we're spending our money on, from public visibility. I mean, once it becomes somebody's business plan, we don't necessarily have a right to that as a competitive matter.
But new polling reveals that 69% of Americans are opposed to the war in Afghanistan.
Wow, 69.
Is that kind of public pressure likely to speed up any withdrawal or disengagement? Because there's already talk about slowing down disengagement.
Yeah, it is. I think that it is important for us to grapple with the relationship between public opinion and national security policy. I think that on a bipartisan basis, it has become very fashionable to say, as Leon Panetta did the other day, that the wars will not be affected by the polls, that American public opinion will not drive what we do here. And we will, you know, it's an extension of what we heard a lot during the Bush administration, which is that we will defer to commanders on the ground. Lindsey Graham said recently that the worst possible thing about Afghanistan, I'm paraphrasing him, would be that politicians would be making decisions about our wars. Well, that's,
like him.
And you know what? That politicians making ideas about the wars, that is the basic idea of the United States of America, and I'm not ready to give it up.
But it is interesting that politicians talk about others as politicians.
Yes.
When Lindsey Graham was doing that, he was really saying people in the White House, the politicians, unlike
I'm not a politician.
Us in Congress.
I'm Lindsey Graham.
I've only been reelected 100 times.
Yeah.
It was announced recently that high-ranking Polish officials will face charges for cooperating with the CIA's Black Sites program of secret prisons. Why do you think there's been so little attention paid in this country to possible illegal actions taken in the name of fighting terrorism?
It is amazing. One of the most amazing changes that has happened in terms of, I think it's fundamental questions about the American project and who we are as a country, is the development of the CIA as effectively another branch of the military. To have elected officials not be answering to the actions of the CIA, because they are actions of the CIA and we don't describe that in public, works to a certain extent with some appropriate discomfort to the when the CIA is acting as an intelligence agency with a small operational component. But when they are operating a network of prisons around the world, when they are operating as another branch of the military, when they are killing as many people as have been killed by CIA-operated drones in Pakistan, it is no longer a small thing that the CIA is that has that much military authority in our country, because we don't have any tradition of having not only operational oversight over what they do, but accountability, even just in terms of public opinion, if we're not allowed to know what they're doing in the first place.
But the president had made that decision fairly early. He said that we should look forward, not backward, when it comes to investigating the CIA's controversial interrogation programs and other national security matters. We haven't seen the modern day equivalent of the Church Committee.
It's true. I would also like to see a public discussion about whether or not the CIA has operational capacity that the U.S. military does not. I understand that they operate under different political and legal constraints than the U.S. military. But are there things they do that, for example, the United States Air Force is not capable of doing, that the Joint Special Operations Command is not capable of doing? If not, if they are only doing these military operations because they can get away with it and the military wouldn't be allowed to, I would like to debate that. And I think that the arguments for that should be held up to pretty strict scrutiny.
But presidents also revel in the glory of a win, a military win. This is partly why they wind up getting involved in these things.
And that's, you know, you could write a Homeric epic on the subject. I mean, that is what the founders were so explicit about.
And it's why Barack Obama will run on, "We killed Osama bin Laden."
And he will also run on, "I brought you home from Iraq." I mean, not every president is the same, but there is a principle, I think, recognized throughout Western history that you end up having incentives to warfare as an individual leader that do not accrue to a group, to a legislative body. And that is why, with studied care, the Constitution vests the question of war making in the legislature.
My guest is Rachel Maddow. Her book, I was going to say her latest book, but it's your first.
It's my only book.
It's called Drift, and it is published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Often your show highlights things that you feel aren't getting enough coverage in the rest of the media. How do you select which material to run each night?
Through a painstaking, bone-grinding process that's killing me slowly. It's the most interesting and most difficult part of my workday every day, is deciding, based on what I understand to be the universe of news, what I ought to make TV about that night. And it's a collective process that I make with all the people, all the very smart people who I work with, but it's hard. And, you know, I think we get it right about 15% of the time, and the other 85% of the time, I'm filled with regret and self-loathing. It's hard. It's hard.
Well, do you watch a lot of other cable news?
No, I don't watch any. I don't have time. I'm prepping for my own.
Yeah, but where do you get your information? Obviously, you're looking for underreported stories or other angles on stories that we're only hearing one side of.
You know, I don't set out to find things that other people aren't talking about. I try to find what I think is important in the world. And then sometimes in coming up with an explanation of what's important in the world, I realize that this is something that is not getting a lot of attention, or that's maybe getting attention from a totally different angle from which I'm approaching it. And I will point that out. But that's never the reason why I want to cover something.
Whenever people criticize the biases that they perceive in Fox News, Fox's defenders point to you as a liberal version of what Fox does. Do you see yourself as an ideological counterbalance to someone like Sean Hannity?
No. I don't see myself as balancing or compensating or reflecting really anybody else. I'm too busy to work on what I'm doing. I think, you know, Fox is its own thing. And Fox is very, 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 very successful in the cable news world. And if you combined everybody in cable news on a single day over all hours in primetime, we'd all be beat by the deadliest catch. So I think that our own sense of our importance and the nuances among us is maybe a little inflated.
And the back of your book includes a blurb from Roger Ailes, yeah, who kind of compliments you.
It does. He's saying, I mostly disagree, but this is some interesting points. I wanted to do that because I wanted to make a point that I never make explicitly in the book, but I think is implicit throughout it, which is that this is not left versus right. There's a lot of things in our politics that are left versus right, and they're fun to talk about every day. But this is one of those issues where there is not a neat partisan divide. And I actually think that makes it more solvable.
Although Ailes writes, "People who like Rachel will love the book. People who don't will get angry. But aggressive debate is good for America."
He and I agree on that.
And then he says, "Drift is a book worth reading." I don't know where to go from here, whether we should talk more about the military. There's so many things going on. We're going to be talking about a secret NSA data gathering facility in a tiny town in Utah. And this is the sort of thing that you would think would be the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah. The growth of and the Washington Post did such yeoman's work on this in their epic, epic expose on this last year. But the whole idea of top secret America and its expansion since 9/11 is almost by definition underappreciated because it's top secret. But the one of the things that I was hopeful about the Obama presidency was the way that he talked about the problem of overclassification, that there should be a bias toward openness and that you should have to prove the need for classification and not the reverse. And that was something that was talked about in his campaign and early in his administration during the transition. I think that it is not the way that the administration has worked out, that we have a problem of not only the persecution of whistleblowers, but also I think there is a huge amount of what we do as a country that is secret beyond what it needs to be for operational reasons.
And why do you think he has been so aggressive against whistleblowers?
I don't know, actually. And it's I mean, the idea that whether or not it's operationally motivated, I don't think it's ideologically motivated, but it is one of the things that it's interesting. When you have a Democratic president, the pressure from the left on them is something that I think Democrats feel much easier, much happier ignoring than the pressure on them from the right. And it's the reverse with a Republican president. So we get very few answers on these issues.
The assumption is that the people on the left are going to vote for the Democrat even if they don't exactly love him, and the same thing with the Republicans.
Yeah, George W. Bush didn't worry too much about that criticism that Medicare Part D was an unfunded, expensive thing because he knew that Republicans would vote for him.
But what happens when they start running for the general election and then they have to move to the middle? In the case of Barack Obama, he was already pretty much in the middle, although there are still people who think that he's leading us to socialism. How is Mitt Romney going to, the likely Republican candidate, how is he going to wind up appealing to all of those independents he's going to have to get voted for, votes from?
I find Mitt Romney to be amazing in every way. I mean, in a lot of ways. He was my governor in Massachusetts, and you can watch his approval ratings over his short time as governor drop like a stone falling through water. I mean, he's good at getting elected, and I don't expect that it's going to be I think this is probably going to be a close-fought election. I have no sense that it's certainly going to be an easy reelect for the president, unless, you know, Romney picks Santorum as his VP or something ridiculous. But I think that Romney is good at presenting a stylistically moderate character for traditional conservative policies. And if the country's in that kind of mood, anything could happen.
Do you think your early work as an AIDS activist has informed how you approach the political process today? Have you always been a political animal?
Thank you for that question. I think that it has affected, you know, it's interesting. I was an AIDS activist from the time that I was a teenager until I really started in media, and then I didn't really stop doing it until I moved to New York in 2004 to join Air America. But the other thing that happened alongside my activism is I did a lot of my academic work in that same field. I was an AIDS in prison activist, prison reform activist, and then I wrote my dissertation on the same topic. And so I've done a lot of thinking about that both operationally and from the sort of ivory tower look at it. And I do think that that work, both types of that work, helped me understand how political actors get things done, both because I've tried to do it and I've studied what works.
Well, ACT UP was a reaction to the earlier approach within the gay community, which was let's all try to be as reasonable looking as possible. ACT UP started doing some pretty outrageous things. It worked there. And it doesn't seem to have worked as well for the Occupy movement. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the Occupy movement is a work in progress. And ACT UP was a much more unified body. It was not as dispersed and multifaceted as the Occupy movement is. So I'm not sure how things are going to end up for the Occupy movement. I think the way that they have been able to be especially effective at small targeted actions, like their report to the SEC, their public comment on the SEC, litigation, or SEC legislation, stuff like that, the ways they've been able to stop individual foreclosures and change the national dialogue, I think they've been pretty damn effective.
Why do you think there are so many more out lesbians in the American media than there are openly gay men?
Is that true?
I think so.
Really?
I can't think of...
I'm trying to count.
We hear rumors of a few people, but... And is it true that your parents only found out you were gay by reading it in a newspaper?
Yeah, that was a failure on my part. I was 17 and very cocky, and there was only me and one other person who were out in my whole freshman class at college. And I came out and then wanted to talk to the student newspaper about it because I was so full of myself and so impressed with myself. And then when the student newspaper wrote it up, they said they would publish it in the next week. And I said, good, because I'm going home this weekend to tell my parents before it ends up in the paper. And they published it before the weekend. Somebody mailed it to my parents, and that was a very mean thing I did to Bobbiny Lane Maddow.
Getting back to being a broadcaster, when I first started revealing things that other people were not talking about, I felt like, wow, I'm just going to blow the lid on this. And it didn't happen.
No.
What do you hope will come out of people watching your show?
I am trying to increase the amount of useful information in the world. I don't think of myself as an activist. I think of myself as giving people information that they can do with what they will. And sometimes the information is so moving or outraging or exciting that I expect that people actually will do something on the basis of it, although I'd never ask them to. But mostly I want to help make things make more sense in a way that is both true and engaging. I like people who pay attention to politics and the news. I wish more people did. I think people are happier when they do. And so that's all I'm hoping for.
And when people look at your biography and they hear that you once worked as a mascot in an inflatable calculator suit.
That's right.
Are they surprised? Are you surprised?
I think I'm kind of a dork. I'm not sure that anybody's surprised.
Yeah, you also say that you used to go to monster truck rallies. I imagine you don't have the time to do that anymore.
No, and I'm too concerned about hearing loss. So, that's the other reason I can't do that anymore.
Rachel Maddow, you can see her every night on MSNBC, and you can read her new book, Drift, the Unmooring of American Military Power. It is published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You're great, Leonard. Thank you so much for having me here. This has been so much fun.